Now, producers of the Fox TV show Empire say they're removing actor Jussie Smollett from this season's two remaining episodes.
The move came after Smollett was charged with disorderly conduct and falsifying a police report. The actor, who is black and gay, said he was attacked by two men in Chicago who yelled homophobic and racist slurs and told him he was in Trump country. After investigating, police say Smollett set the whole thing up himself because he was unhappy with his salary.
Many liberals on social media initially expressed outrage over the first reports of the attack, calling it a disturbing case of Trump-era racism and hate. Conservatives accused them of rushing to judgment and portraying Trump supporters as bigots. Our next guest says the reaction to the incident is evidence of confirmation bias. Noah Rothman is the associate editor of Commentary Magazine and author of the new book, Unjust: Social Justice and the Unmaking of America. Noah, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, there's still allegations. The whole story is maybe not quite sorted out, but you wrote about this looking back from this vantage point. What do you think people got wrong after the initial reports?
Well, the desire to treat victims, legitimate victims, with a certain amount of deference and to provide them with psychic and even material rewards is good. It's natural. But when we reduce the barriers, the thresholds, the evidentiary standards that a victim is supposed to meet in order to convey some sort of, or defer rather to some sort of historical sense of justice for aggrieved classes of individuals, we stop treating people like people and we start treating them like members of a collective tribe. And that is really typical of how the modern social justice movement navigates the environment and the prescriptions that it has for policy and for social change. And this isn't the first time that we've seen hate crime hoaxes. It's only one of the most recent episodes. And we could have known what this looked like if we were cognizant of that pattern and the social justice activism that animates it. But this movement is very critical to reflections. It's very resistant to introspection. And my book is an attempt to force some introspection on this movement, on the social justice activists right and left who have adopted a lot of ideas that are antithetical to the American experiment.
You wrote in that opinion piece you wrote in the New York Times that, in fact, there are real hate crimes up there, and the FBI is reporting that they're on the rise. With that in mind, I mean, are you surprised that people are seeing real hate crimes? They see another report and think, ah, this fits that pattern.
Yeah, so, and this is something I wasn't aware of, but hate crime reports are obviously distinct from hate crime indictments and prosecutions. A lot of new agencies are reporting on this data, and that data comes from 2017, where we had about 7,000 plus reports of hate crime incidents. But in that same year, the number of federal indictments handed down specifically for hate crimes was a whopping eight. With 14 convictions on 14 counts. The notion here that there is some sort of a plague is advanced by the idea that the country as a whole is beset by racial prejudice and bigotry, and it's almost a faith. It's something that is very resistant to factual challenges, and that's not a figment of anybody's imagination. The social justice movement originates out of the church. It is a religious concept originally. Its vestigial religious traits is something that is probably part of its DNA. And the movement as a whole, while dedicated to some pretty noble ideas, the notion that we should how to think about justice and fairness and an egalitarian society, righting historical wrongs, it's pretty unobjectionable. But the movement's activists have embraced ideas in order to affect that sort of change that I think are really psychologically damaging and utterly alien to the American experience. Notions like the fact that meritocracy in this country is a myth, that agency is a lie, that your individual traits, your demography at birth, sets you on a course in life that is in many ways predestined. That's segregation to prevent social discomfort, racial, demographic, or otherwise, is good. And that colorblindness in institutions is naive at best and probably more likely dangerous. And social justice activists on the left might not realize that white supremacists believe all this stuff too. This sort of toxic racial consciousness is at the heart of this movement. It's very damaging. It's certainly counterproductive. And it's something that I think is alien to the American experiment and needs to be stopped.
Talking to Noah Rothman from Commentary Magazine, author of the new book, Unjust, Social Justice and the Unmaking of America. Talk about a piece he wrote about the response to this case in Chicago, the TV actor Jussie Smollett claiming to be the victim of a hate crime. Police now charging him with false reports. Noah, is the reaction to this a sign of something to do with the social justice movement, or is this just how we react to stuff on the internet now? We see a thing wherever we are on the political spectrum. We react according to our preconceived notions, and we run with it.
Yeah, I mean, that's a distinction without a difference, right? Whether or not how we react to stuff on the internet and whether or not this is a function of the social justice movement. The social justice movement lives on the internet. It thrives in that environment. And there are actual serious social consequences for transgressing against the social justice movement's prescriptions and its way of thinking about things. Just deference to its preferred nostrums is really all that it demands of its adherents. And I think really specifically about the phenomenon that resulted from resulted after the erection of a statue in Lower Manhattan, Fearless Girl. Fearless Girl was a bronze statue erected in Lower Manhattan, and it was feted by Democratic speakers and politicians. Bill de Blasio said it was a serious, significant challenge to the patriarchy, and men were very offended by it. Gail Collins in the New York Times said it was the most effective protest against male domination of the financial services industry since the antebellum protests that desegregated the trolleys. It turns out this statue was sponsored by a firm, State Street Global Advisors, which was ostensibly trying to raise awareness for the lack of women in C-suite executive positions in the financial services industry. But it wasn't long before we realized the whole point of this statue. After a Department of Labor audit, they found that this firm had been systematically discriminating against its female employees. It settled with about 305 women to the tune of $5 million. Just paying not deference to the ideas of social justice allowed this firm to evade a lot of scrutiny that it deserved. But because it was able to tug on the heartstrings and demonstrate that its heart was in the right place, it was able to receive some indulgences from the social justice minders who are very aware of transgressions against its norms. This isn't the only case. It's only one of the most prominent. But it's indicative of how this movement is rendered gullible and manipulable by these tenets of what has really become a new faith.
You mentioned earlier the phrase social justice on the left and the right. People, I think, usually associate with the left. Where do you see it on the right?
Yeah, so the social justice movement on the left has embraced a lot of what I said earlier, psychologically damaging concepts, these ideas that amount to the notion that you are a victim in life, that you are unable to navigate society. It is an unnavigable matrix of prejudices with obstacles placed before you by powers that be, which are ill-defined, and they prevent you from realizing your success in life. So much so that you must defer to a higher power, an authority, to restore that which is your due. Again, white supremacists, white nationalists believe all this too. The distinctions between the far left and far right social justice activists in a sort of a mindset, a foundational philosophical approach to life, are so blurred that I often decline to make them. These two ideas, which are relegated only to the fringes now, are being drawn on by the center at increasing rates that I think are very, very disturbing. It's a powerful notion to say to somebody that your lot in life is not of your own making. It disempowers you, but ironically, it's a very effective way of creating a durable political coalition. Conservatives used to know all this stuff. They used to know that identity politics practiced in this fashion was disempowering and detrimental to the social fabric. But its power and its appeal are tempting for individuals who are looking to create a political coalition. And I think that that in many ways, Donald Trump's ascendancy to the White House was predicated on a lot of these notions that the lot of certain people's lives was not in their own making, that higher powers discriminated against your identity, be it white, Christian, male, what have you, that foreign labor and foreign capital were being imported in this country to provide unfair competition and to rob you of your due. That's disempowering. It's a toxic notion. It fosters grievance and identity politics, but it also creates a very durable political coalition. Democrats have known this for a long time, and Republicans are just beginning to catch on.
A social justice advocate, I guess, if we can define a generic term there, might say, okay, For black people in America, they have had the real experience of slavery, Jim Crow, lynching, segregation, separate but equal, and so on, up to redlining in the banks, efforts to prevent them voting, whereas the white nationalists can't point to that experience. Are you saying really they're equally valid?
No,
or invalid?
Redlining is actually a very specific case, and it shows up in my book. That was an effort by public sector forces, by the government, to facilitate the sort of economic justice that I think a lot of social justice advocates think is valid and necessary today. This is the government knocking on your door saying, I'm here to help. And what they did was actually segregate a lot of urban centers in the effort to keep people in their homes during the Great Depression. That's indicative of sort of the problem that I'm trying to address here, which is that an over-reliance on the private sector to address these grievances is detrimental to the overall cause. This book is not an attack on racial awareness, on self-actualization. That's the sort of thing that I think is arguing from a position of ignorance. What this is an attack on is a certain notion, an idea of social, of racial and cultural awareness as sufficing for a governing ethos. Social justice has become an alternative theory of how societies organize themselves, which is alien to the United States, but not alien to societies abroad. Thinking of individuals not as individuals, but as representatives of their particular class or tribe, is really just how politics functions in most of old Europe and in East Asia. It's the sort of thing that I think should be resisted vehemently here, but it's becoming increasingly attractive.
Talking to Noah Rothman. He's the associate editor of Commentary Magazine, author of the book Unjust, Social Justice, and the Unmaking of America. Our starting point was the Empire actor Jussie Smollett, his case reporting a hate crime, now charged with false reporting.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the Smollett story, and especially the early media reports and reactions? What lessons do you hope people learn from this? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or tweet us at Central Time WPR.
We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Chris Molina. We're talking with Noah Rothman about Empire actor Jussie Smollett. He says there's a reckoning coming to those who rushed to judgment after Smollett said he was attacked by a couple of racist, homophobic supporters of President Trump. Chicago police said last week that the actor staged the attack because he wasn't happy with his salary.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been following that story and the response in the media, social media, and beyond? Do you think we've lost the ability to think critically? Are we too knee-jerk with our reactions? Do you agree with our guest that we might go in with a social justice mindset, he says, that makes us judge things maybe before all the facts are in? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also tweet us at Central Time WPR. Noah, bringing things back to this kind of incident, we see shocking incidents reported on, shared, especially on social media all the time. What would you like to see from people in the media, too, on how we react on those initial reports?
Yeah. So I'm asked this question a lot. How should we react when these things happen? And the answer is very unsatisfying. It's don't. We do not react. We do not run off half-cocked with the assumption that we understand all these events and by virtue of the players involved. Because in order to make that assessment, we have to rely on stereotypes. We have to see individuals not as individuals, but as representatives of their collective class or tribe. This is indicative of how a lot of these racial hoaxes, racial hate crime hoaxes, unfold on college campuses, and only recently, after 2016, how they've become an increasingly dominant feature of American political life in this country. What happened to, for example, the individuals who prejudged the situation involving Justice Brett Kavanaugh was very similar. The paucity of evidence before us in that case, hard evidence that we could actually pore over, was such that people began to probe their own personal experiences in order to understand these events. They began to talk about their experiences in college and high school, the people who they knew who were like Brett Kavanaugh. And from there, you had a critical mass of members of the elite community media, political, entertainment elites discussing Brett Kavanaugh in a way that in any other context we would describe as prejudice. They talked about him as a white male with a particular socioeconomic background, a member of a class in a tribe that was due a comeuppance, a reckoning. Whether or not he, as an individual, had done any of the things of which he was accused, criminal allegations, albeit not prosecutable allegations, was immaterial almost. The reckoning that was due here, according to people like Matthew Dowd and Maureen Dowd and Hillary Clinton communications advisor Jennifer Palmieri and Martina Navratilova and half a dozen other individuals who are very influential, was that this was a white man who was resistant to this cultural reckoning of which he had been caught up in. That's not any kind of justice. We're not talking about justice anymore. We're talking about revenge, downward social leveling, and whether or not Brett Kavanaugh deserved it or not is immaterial. He was caught up in the currents of history. That's not justice. That's the sort of thing that is very familiar to an anti-egalitarian societies. But that's not this society. That's not the American ideal.
Is this anything that new? You can go back to Aaron Burr being accused, as his post-shooting Alexander Hamilton, being accused of a treason plot that fell apart after a lot of hoopla due to a lot of really not much evidence there. Are times that really that different now? And is it really because of a social justice movement?
No, I mean, it's certainly not new. The tribal impulse is so ingrained in the human condition that it's probably an evolutionary trait. That doesn't make it noble or valid. It's just an acknowledgement that this is with us. The American ideal, when I raise this issue on the American meritocratic egalitarian ideal, when I raise this issue from college campuses, you get a lot of resistance from students who only know of the American ideal that it's failed. We fail to live up to it. So, and if that's all you know, then why would you think it's worth preserving? This, to me, is a misapprehension of what the word ideal is. An ideal is aspirational. You may never achieve it, but that does not give you license to abandon the project, because the fundamental notions at its heart, the really base root concepts that animated the founders, you know, people don't read the Federalist Papers anymore, but they certainly don't read the people who animated the founders. Nobody reads Edmund Burke or Montesquieu anymore. The notions at the heart of the American founding, foundational English common law concepts like the presumption of innocence, have not been improved upon, and the efforts to reboot justice have been abject failures that create a slew of more victims, the most recent example of which is the Dear Colleague letter, the status quo that resulted from the Dear Colleague letter in 2011, where we rebooted justice, essentially. It was the guidelines that were provided to college campuses that said how they could essentially redefine sexual assault and adjudicate these claims on campus, because the American justice system was ill-equipped to adjudicate these cases fairly. Evidentiary standards for conviction were too high. Forcing an accuser to confront their abuser was too traumatic. So they had to adjudicate these claims on campus tribunals. And when those verdicts were examined in real courtrooms, they found that accused and accuser of alike were frequently deprived of their First, Fifth, and Sixth Amendment rights. Millions of dollars were handed out to the students who were abused in these tribunals, and all because of an effort to redefine justice along the lines of what social justice advocates think is more valuable. It wasn't justice that they were seeking in the end. It was revenge, and it turned out to create a whole lot more victims.
Do you see a backlash or a positive response, as you would see it, switching things back in another direction?
You know, I wish I did. Unfortunately, I am fighting against the tide. You know, this sort of social justice activism is very popular. I don't foresee any real changes coming anytime soon. Unfortunately, this book is an effort to really begin the process of looking at these members of political coalitions, very important, very influential members of both Republican and Democratic political coalitions, and saying, look, maybe this association just isn't worth it. Maybe we've gotten into bed with some people who are making us less attractive to a critical mass of voters, 50 plus one at the polls. That's the argument that I make in the very final chapters of this book, that certain concepts have rendered these social justice movements less attractive to the political coalitions that they are trying to be a member of. For example, the Democratic Party has had to dissociate itself from the Women's March movement, because of many of the pieties that it had adopted from that are popular on the social justice left, adhering to the theory of intersectionality. Intersectionality is a perfectly valid way to see how prejudice manifests in the real world, but it forced them to look at their allies, not as allies, but as disparate members of potential enemy classes. because some of them had disparate traits that were more discriminated against or less discriminated against than others. So this movement, it was engaged in an anti-Semitism row because its allies, who were Jewish and white, were, in the words of Tamika Mallory, one of the organizers, purveyors of white supremacy, whether they knew it or not. They couldn't possibly be allies, even if they agreed to everything that we believed in. They still possessed these demographic traits that render them something of an adversary. It ended up tearing the movement apart, and it disempowered them, because eventually Democrats had to dissociate from them. I think more and more that's going to continue to happen, and if we can educate individuals as to how these philosophies are robbing them of power, or stealing their agency from them, then I think it becomes less attractive.
We'll leave it there. Noah, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That's Noah Rothman, associate editor of Commentary Magazine, author of the new book, Unjust, Social Justice, and the Unmaking of America. We talked about, among other things, actor Jussie Smollett, accused of paying two men to stage an attack on him in downtown Chicago, and our guests' wider concerns about the social justice movement.